Are you looking for an accessible way to grow as an intern or pastor? Reformed Theological Seminary offers a hybrid Master of Divinity, allowing those in ministry to deepen their theological understanding without leaving their current position or relocating their families. Under the guidance of esteemed Reformed Evangelical instructors, students gain experience in both theoretical and practical aspects of ministry, with a blend of online and in-person courses. At RTS, you'll deepen your love for God as you prepare to serve the church. To learn more, visit rts.edu/gospelbound and receive a complimentary book for a limited time. That's rts.edu/gospelbound. For a long time, we thought bigger was better. Church growth and numbers dominated our thoughts and conversations. But now more than ever, people are feeling disconnected. Trust in the church is dwindling. Desizing the Church is a new book by pastor and author Carl Vaders that invites us to consider how removing church size from the equation can be essential in rebuilding trust, restoring relationships, and renewing our spiritual lives. Desizing the Church reframes the way we see fruitfulness and success in ministry. It's time to end the obsession with church growth and focus on what really matters. Pick up your copy of Desizing the Church today at moodypublishers.com.
Welcome to Gospel Bound, a podcast from the Gospel Coalition for those searching for resolute hope in an anxious age. I'm your host, Colin Hansen, and each week I'm joined by insightful guests to talk about their written work and how the gospel applies to all of life. Together, we keep looking until we see God working. Wherever you're listening, welcome. I'm glad you're here for today's conversation. It's amazing how often a higher calling is buried by problems, smallness, and self-interest. It is the leader's job to lift the sights of an organization to a higher place. People want to be part of something great, and they will rise to the occasion if given the chance. And it's the leader's job to help lift them to that place. That quote is from a recent talk delivered by Steve Preston, who is president and CEO of Goodwill Industries International, which is the largest nonprofit workforce developer in North America. I connected with Steve a few years ago and got to know him better last year as TGC was launching the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics. Now, Steve is an unassuming man, but I need to make him a bit uncomfortable by running through his resume. He served as the 14th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That was from 2008 to 2009. And the 22nd Administrator of the U.S. Small Business Administration from 2006 until his appointment as HUD Secretary. I know he'd wanted me to point out that he, before entering public service, Steve spent nearly 25 years in the private sector. But Steve knows that I like him mainly because he's a Northwestern University graduate and a regular listener of Gospel Bound. Now, in all seriousness, I could tell you stories about Steve's involvement behind the scenes with Reformed University Fellowship, various church plants, the Board of Wheaton College, and even the Northwestern administration. I met Steve and his wife Molly while working on my book about Timothy Keller. Prestons were early members at Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York, and Steve's comments for that book stood out to me before I learned anything or knew anything about his background. Now, Steve's work experience shows how strong leaders break the chain of problems from advancing beyond them. Here's a line from one of his talks that I really like. Quote, "So many times larger crises are averted because good leaders have taken a stand, done the right thing, and been willing to stand tall when others were not, because they held fast to what they believed was right." Now, in this interview, we're going to learn more about that history, and we'll talk about Goodwill, which I'm sure almost all of you know from its 3,300 stores where we donate and shop. I've told Steve that my late grandmother might have been Goodwill's biggest fan. I'm not sure whether she donated or purchased more, but now that I think about it, definitely she purchased a lot more. Now, for nearly 120 years, Goodwill has recruited, trained, and placed employees who otherwise may have been trapped in poverty without meaningful work that blesses their neighbors. And so Steve Preston joins me now on Gospel Bound to share more about his journey, how his faith in God carries him through various decisions and leadership challenges. Steve, welcome to Gospel Bound.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you. I feel a little like I snuck in through the side door. You know, I haven't written a book, so I have a little bit of imposter syndrome here.
So it's going to be wonderful, Steve. It's going to be great. Well, let's just start with your story. Start from the beginning. How did you come to faith in Jesus Christ?
Yeah, so I did not grow up in a Christian family. I spent the summer as a 12-year-old away with relatives on my father's side. They were very strong Christians. And they really had this a faith that really wrapped them in all they did. They grew up very poor. They grew up in the coal mines. And they really clung to their faith throughout life. And so being in that environment with them for a summer, I really came to understand what that faith looked like up close as well as I could at that age. And I just really never doubted it after that. It was that summer that I accepted Christ, and really my life was changed immediately and forever as a result.
How did your family respond to that? Was this a positive thing from their perspective, a negative thing, confusion? How did they respond?
Kind of all those things.
Answer D, all of the above.
I came home, and it was sort of a range of going from indifference to outright rejection. So I had older brothers. They were both teenagers. Let's say they were fully embracing their adolescence. and I had a couple sisters that were much younger than me, and so it really wasn't on their radar screen. But my father, who had grown in that faith tradition, had fully rejected it. And it actually wasn't until his death a couple of months ago that I came to understand that his rejection was based on the teaching that his salvation was not secure. Mm-hmm. And so he never felt like he could live in confidence, and he finally fully rejected it. Now, thankfully, many years after that, he came to a fuller understanding of the veracity of God's grace through all things. And he came back to the faith. But in my situation, I have to say my life changed immediately. And I grew up in kind of a rough and tumble setting. I knew a lot of things and did a lot of things as a 12-year-old that I still can't quite believe. And I was sort of, you know, following the path that had been set before me. But when I came back home, I stepped back from a lot of the friends I had. I found a church, I found a youth group, and that really put me on a very different path. And I do recall, as much as possible at that age, really developing a very different vision for my life. And once I got my driver's license, I started taking my sisters to church, and they came to faith, which was really special. But when I was in my senior year in college and looking forward to going to school, I just felt this tremendous burden that, you know, my older brothers and my parents were still not, had not accepted Christ. I sort of felt that burden was on me. And toward the end of my senior year, my mother said, you know, your father and I realize what a good influence this has been on your life. And we don't want your sisters to stop going to church. So we're going to start taking them to church when you go to college. And all I can say is within a year of my going to college, my one brother would come to Christ through friends in the military. Ultimately, he became a pastor. My father came to Christ, became an elder in the church. Oh. And my brother came back and evangelized my other brother and my mother. And so, which if you just sort of know the pre and post story on him was truly miraculous. And it was really the first really powerful example in my life of seeing that God's ways are greater than mine, and that he's just deeply worthy of our trust. And so it put me, I think, in a different place of confidence in my faith and what was possible.
Connect us from there to how you end up in New York. What happens in the middle? What takes you to New York from this rough and tumble background?
Well, I was a good student. I'd been applying myself. That was part of the changed life. And I didn't really know where I was going to college. My parents hadn't gone to college. In fact, my father hadn't graduated high school. I got a little postcard from Northwestern, and I lived 100 miles away. I didn't even know what it was. And the deeper I looked into it, the more I realized that might be a good opportunity. And, you know, one thing led to another. I went there. And then after graduating, a firm in Chicago offered to put me through University of Chicago to get an MBA. And at age 25, I was a newly minted MBA in finance. I became an investment banker at a major Wall Street investment bank. I say it that way because it sounds better than saying Lehman Brothers now. It sounded pretty good. Now I try to go sort of, no brand names anymore. And it was sort of a striking trajectory for me because I was 25 years old, working in Hong Kong on a big assignment, and my father was unemployed and experiencing significant financial challenges. And I sort of realized that God had put me in a fundamentally different place and on a fundamentally different path than the one I'd come from. And part of what I was dealing with was understanding what that really meant for me. The other part of that is I was a guy in my 20s in New York City. I didn't have deep theological roots. I was looking for a strong faith community, but I certainly had one foot kind of firmly planted in the scene of New York in the 1980s. And so I visited a number of churches that were, or actually attended a couple that were actually very focused on evangelism. But, you know, New York in the 1980s was a very tough place. And I just felt this intense need for the church to be serving the city in ways that a lot of the churches I was attending weren't, and to be caring about the deepest human needs in the city. And then other churches that I'd looked into, and one that I attended ultimately, really hard heart for people in need, but they lacked fidelity to many of the tenets of our faith. And it left me feeling like I wasn't really on solid ground. Like they were caring about things that were important, but the rock solid foundation wasn't there. And so a friend urged me to try out a brand new church that was just starting with this great pastor. It was Tim Keller. And so I visited and I never left. I was hooked after the first service. Tim had diagnosed the condition of the New York young professional and sort of the thinness of our fixations, the things that were driving us, our counterfeit gods, as he would, later write about. And he pointed us to, really what was authentic and what was eternal. And he also loved this city, and he believed in the importance of Christians serving in the city. And all of that was like wrapped in this strong foundation of theology. So for me, so much came together for me in terms of making sense of my faith and making it real in my life and beginning to see a vision for what God was calling me to be and to do in my life. And it put me in a different place and in a fundamentally different pathway because of that experience.
One of the things I loved most working on the book about Tim was talking to a lot of people from over the years at Redeemer, again, starting with you guys. But it was so fun to think about what Tim and Kathy set out to do in New York, what they prayed to see, and to see the fruit of that. You know, I think about Bob and Heidi Jenkins, and I think about them living on the Upper East Side and all the plans to reach people on the Upper East Side, them coming to faith. I think about the way they anticipated all these people who would be moving into the city to take these jobs, and who would be there to shepherd them and who would be there to help them to see that God had a plan for them to serve the city and not just to take from the city, but to truly be planted there and to care for their neighbors. I'm wondering, Steve, how did you develop? I mean, that background, except for parts of your childhood, I wouldn't say that's a natural avenue toward sensing a strong call to serve the poor. I'm just wondering how many investment banking associates in the 1980s spent their weekends volunteering with the poor. Yeah, where'd that come from?
Well, I have to, let me just start out by telling a funny little story. How many investment bankers, so I was actively recruiting other young professionals to serve on the weekends in a particular tutoring program. The program had gotten a hold of a cheap baby blue van, and I would pick up people on a couple of different street corners, And once again, New York was a different place in the 80s. And I would sort of drive this baby blue van right through Harlem and through the potholes and double parked cars up to the church to tutor. And so they got a whole, they got the full experience in their volunteer activities. But so, and by the way, I loved driving in New York, but most people didn't love driving with me. So I wanted to give, make sure it was worth their time. So, you know, for me, Colin, it started out really just with a love for children and just a sense of burden for their circumstances. And living in New York and having a sense of the environment that so many children were growing up. And I just wanted to be somebody in their lives that was a positive force. And hopefully help them point to something different, you know. And by the way, you know, for me, spending time with kids was just such a sweet part of my life back then, because I was just running so hard in my work all the time, and so that this was sort of a pocket of sweetness that I just looked forward to so much. But then I realized that they were teaching me. Right. I grew in my understanding of what their lives looked like in all of the brokenness that surrounded them, and so many reflections, right? Their families, their schools, the violence around them, the stories people told them. And all of those influences were shaping them. And so that time was very informative for me in helping me understand how so many people end up on those difficult paths. And it was during that time that I started mentoring a teenager. And it was through him that understanding really deepened very significantly. You know, it was somebody who had had sort of a very troubled pathway. I was asked to begin spending time with him. He, you know, met me with a lot of suspicion, and it was a long road. But ultimately, we really became a part of each other's lives. And I remember telling him once, "Look, because I knew where things could potentially go with him." And I said, "You know, before you ever do anything stupid, you come straight to me." I remember just saying, like, "Don't make the bad decision. Just come to me. That's the hatch." Right. And so, you know, you've met my wife. Molly and I had been engaged for, I think, 6 weeks. We'd had dinner. I put her in a taxi and I was walking home. And sure enough, I saw him sitting on my stoop.
Oh, wow.
And I went up to him and I said, "You know, what's going on?" And he said, "Look, I've been kicked out of my home." He was living with his mother. He said, "I can't go back. I have a standing offer to sell drugs in the village. And but you told me to come to you, and here I am." And so, as only sort of a single guy without a lot of judgment would do, I said, "Sure, come on and live with me. We'll figure this out together." Yeah. And I had a chance to listen to how he thought and what he faced every day, and what his assumptions were about me and about other things. And people like him in situations like that learn to negotiate their way through the world based on the world they're in. You know, that might, as I mentioned before, it might be poverty or violence or abuse, certainly poor education, no understanding of what the opportunities are outside of them. And so when we work with people who find the, you know, who are in difficult situations, we need to understand where they've come from. And one of the things I learned was through him was at a relatively early age, because of all of those influences, his wiring had become pretty formed, and it becomes increasingly formed through adolescence and adulthood. And I saw what it would take, to the degree that I could, what it would take to disentangle that wiring for him to be able to move forward, and how difficult that was even at a young age. But I also saw the tremendous potential inside of him. And so when we look at people that we're trying to help, especially people that have been on this pathway for a while and have had sort of compounded challenges, we need to see the entire need that presents itself and how to work through it. And then, Colin, when I went to HUD, which is probably 15 years later, HUD's the agency that deals more with poverty issues, really, than any of the other federal agencies. I felt like I saw what had become of those kids that didn't make it out, that didn't move on. And eventually, I think that was the big reason that God put upon my heart the need to serve adults with the kind of challenges that we see throughout our country.
Yeah. Now, these days, when you start talking about a lot of these challenges related to poverty, urban development, you quickly become entangled in various theoretical frameworks surrounding race, justice, poverty. How do we get focused and stay focused on meeting those tangible needs without getting sidetracked? I mean, some of those conversations can be healthy and helpful, but many times it seems as though that's what people want to do is have that debate and not help the actual people in front of them in their neighborhoods, their cities.
Yeah, and I do agree that a thoughtful investigation of those types of issues is important for policy solutions and to deal with bigger issues. But so much of that discussion has become weaponized. And I get very concerned that that fight is diverting our focus away and our hearts away from the urgent call to serve individuals with deep needs that are suffering all around us every day and people that we need to stand alongside of. I just feel like there are so many people in society that are on the outside looking in, and they're not able to benefit from the riches of our society, which are vast, by the way, or as a lot of people like to say, the promise of America, right? And there are a lot of reasons for that. And I think to address this bigger issue, we need to face the truth with respect to the depth of the problem, because it is deep and complicated, and it derives from some of the things I just talked about. But I also think we have to be able to believe that there's enormous value to every one of us, not just those people, to every one of us in addressing those problems. And I think we need to go forward with the knowledge and the belief that if we do the hard work to move forward, we can be successful. And as Christians, you know, every human being, we know every human being is an image bearer of God. People are born with incredible potential, but for various reasons, that potential goes underdeveloped. You know, I heard somebody recently say, potential is evenly distributed, but opportunity is not. The first thing I said is, I wish that had been my original quote. I'm going to take it. But it's so true. You know, it's potential is evenly distributed. Talent is. Hope is. But so many people have very difficult pathways, and those are often compounded over time with bad decisions and more brokenness. And realizing that potential, turning that into a reality, may be difficult because so many issues need to be dealt with, but there is a pathway to do it. And I believe specifically, and this is the work we do at Goodwill, is we believe very strongly in helping people develop that potential and eventually allowing that to help them move into gainful employment and self-sufficiently in a fundamentally different life trajectory. And so there's a tremendous amount of value in society of bridging the gap between people with life challenges who are unable to move forward and a different future that includes that self-sufficiency, and I believe a life of flourishing. And when you think about the value of work, obviously we talk a lot about sort of the financial value in the ability to take care of yourselves and your family. But work also brings a place where we can be productive, where we can bring our gifts and turn those into something, where we can develop and grow and hopefully see a different kind of pathway for the future, where we develop in community with other people and have shared goals with them. And ultimately, that all leads, I believe, to essential human flourishing that we all experience in many ways, in part because of our work. And in the populations that we serve, it's also an essential pathway to a sense of dignity. Now, we all believe that every one of us is born with dignity as image bearers of God. And we have, you know, God sees in us, he ascribes us that dignity in a way. But people don't feel it. People don't sense it, and society doesn't ascribe that to them. And I often say when people walk through the doors seeking opportunity and help, we see more of them than they do because they carry with themselves the knowledge and the burdens of their past and their difficulties. And we have this wonderful opportunity to help them not only see a different future, but see a different self in them and what they're capable of doing.
Hmm. Tell you what haunts me thinking about this a lot, Steve, is that, and you know, at the Keller Center, we're focused a lot on the problems of de-churching, of 40 million Americans leaving the church in the last 30 years. A lot of people don't realize that those numbers are coming mostly from the poor. They're coming from the lower middle class, the non-college educated. Higher degrees of education, upward mm-hmm. mobility in society, is correlated with church attendance and church affiliation. One of the things that we found in the Great De-Churching study with the center was just a consistent pattern where people don't go to church because they don't feel as though life is working for them. Mm-hmm. Just feels as though every aspect of society, something has fallen apart. And as that happens, they fall away from the church. So church attendance and church affiliation seems correlated with people who feel though life is working well for them. Mm-hmm. But I'm haunted going back to something, and I don't remember if Tim said this in other occasions. I know he did say it in other occasions. I just remember most prominently saying it at the message for his brother's funeral, where he said, you know, my brother, in that case related to his sexuality, is the kind of person who was attracted to following Jesus. The people who were the outcast, the people who were the down and out. But when I look around our churches, I don't see a lot of those people here. Mm-hmm. So are we sure that we're preaching the same message of hope, the same message of the gospel, the same message of radical grace? That's what I think about a lot, and that's what I thought about with your comments there. How do you see the church, you know, relating to this work that you're doing outside? What should the church know about that work?
Well, excuse me. There's a couple things I think the church should step into. We don't often talk enough about just the incredible degree with which Christ loved the poor and identified with the poor. You know, his first sermon in John, after being tempted, basically was about the poor and the imprisoned, right? When you look in Matthew, when he says, when you serve the least of these, you've served me, I think it's really important to think in terms of what that means. We often think about the poor as people that we reach down to, that we deign to serve. And what Christ is saying is, no, you're not deigning to serve. Yeah. I'm elevating you. You're serving the King, right? And it's throughout the scriptures, you know. I think the church needs to lead with just not only the call to serve the poor, but the fact that that is where the heart of Christ is, and the calling is very high. And we don't always, and the other thing within that is, and I think this is one of the challenges we have, is people don't often identify with the humanity of the people that we're serving. Yeah. The humanity of people who were little children at one point, who had hopes and dreams, who are trying to do the best thing for their kids, who have a real story behind it. And we don't connect with who those people are. We think of them as being sort of other. But they're our neighbors. They're in our communities. And I think our church needs to envision its discussion its engagement with the poor differently as a result, and place the burden on all of our hearts for the needs that those people have.
Yeah. You left New York, worked in various roles, including CFO of a Fortune 500 company. I'm wondering, as we continue to progress in your story, Steve, how you ended up in government. Now, I've noticed a pattern. You do not make the obvious decisions or take the obvious next step up the corporate ladder. And when you arrived in government, it's not like you were set up for success in that job. So bring us up to speed there.
Yeah. And by the way, I think my reference, I meant to say Luke in the last answer.
I figured it was Luke. Yeah.
So all of that's true. Decisions I've made haven't been sort of right out of the book. You know, I left Lehman after 8 years, just before the golden purse that comes with a promotion to managing director with Sight. I went into nonprofit after being a corporate CEO. And then, as you mentioned, I left a great corporate role against the advice of a lot of people I trusted to move my family to DC and take that job. But I want to say that all of those moves were based on a strong sense of calling. And in all of those moves, I was greatly blessed as a result. And so there's it's a good news thing, right? It's a good news thing. But with respect to the government move, so I was working in a large company in Chicago in a very senior role, and I had just felt a strong sense that God was calling me to make a different kind of impact in life. And really prayed through it with Molly for a couple of years, and I received an outreach from somebody in the administration that I had worked with previously, who said, you know, the government, the administration's looking for people who can run things. We have a lot of policy people, but a lot of these agencies are large operations, and we need people who can kind of drive them forward. So for a lot of reasons, I won't get into all the details, but this all really seemed to make sense just, you know, in terms of the prayer process we've been through, the seeking process. And so I entered the process to background checks and all the things you go through when you take on one of these roles. And I was offered an undersecretary role in the Department of Commerce, which was meaningful, very interesting to me. It was sort of just the right thing in terms of what I was hoping for, and also not terribly public because I had not been a public figure before. And then I got a call from the White House right a couple weeks before the announcement. And the first words out of the person's mouth with, "Are you sitting down?" Which, of course, three FBI background checks and everything. And like what could possibly be happening? And he said, "Don't worry about it." He kind of laughed. He said, "I just want to talk to you about something." And he said, "You know, we've been thinking a lot about your candidacy here, and there's a role that is very important to the president that we believe is a higher calling. And we'd like you to consider it, but you don't have to go forward because it's going to be a very difficult job. And if you're not ready for it, it's going to be very public and very challenging. But let's talk." And so it was running the SBA. And what most people don't realize is the Small Business Administration makes loans to homeowners and business owners who've lost their homes or facilities or had them badly damaged in a natural disaster. And it was many months after Hurricane Katrina, and almost none of that money had flowed into the hands of the people who needed it. And in fact, into the hands of many people who'd been approved to receive the loans. And so I Googled the agency, and I realized really what they were talking about. Congress was calling for my predecessor's resignation. SBA was all over the press. It sort of struck me to the core, and I went from a place of feeling like God had given me great clarity to saying, okay, what's going on here? And I realized that I'd been brought along to a place of saying yes, and God was saying, okay, now that I've gotten you to this place, will you really say yes? And so I remember that I'd been sort of given the weekend to think about it. And I remember that weekend in the Sunday school class I was in, we were looking through Exodus 33, and it's sort of Moses talking with God about the path forward with the real Israelites. And he basically says, you know, don't send me if you're not going to, you know, teach me along the way. And if you're not going to go with me, because, you know, people need to see that, you know, we need to be able to bring glory to you effectively. But, and then eventually he says, you know, and now I want you to reveal yourself to me. And I thought to myself, like, that's what I need to do. I need to ask God to go with me so that people could see why I'm here. I need him to teach me, and you know, and I need him to to show me who he is in this place. And I also realized, like many Americans, for the last, at that point, I guess it was 8 months, I'd been watching television. I'd been with reports on the Gulf. I wondered how I could help, you know, thinking I'm sitting in my, you know, living room outside of Chicago, knowing there was no answer to that. And then when I was confronted with this reality, I had to ask myself, who was I really? And I real and yeah. because a lot of people had advised me not to take the role, and the risk was great. But I realized, you know, 30 years from now, do I want to be looking back on my life and saying, you know, I stayed on this great career path in my comfortable setting and kind of did all the right things? Or do I want to be the person who took the call? And you know, I always have that picture in Isaiah 6, is, you know, when Isaiah sees the glory of God, his inadequacy before God, receives atonement, and then in all of that remarkable mix, hearing God say, you know, who will I send? Who will go for us? And of course, Isaiah doesn't ask where or how. He just says, send me, right? And so to me, that was sort of a send me moment. And one that really changed my life. So I guess the real answer is I had no choice. I had no choice because, you know, we'd been praying. My wife is just an incredible partner in these things. And, you know, we got to the point where the opportunity was in front of us. And it happened in most of these situations, perhaps not as dramatically. The other thing I have found in making a lot of big decisions, especially those career decisions, is I start out in a place with a fairly clear notion of where I'm heading. And along that journey, God changes my heart. And he moves me to a different place, or has moved me to a different place. And ultimately, I realize that those decisions are really about taking a step toward joy and toward seeing him in my life and being able to experience those things.
Well, you've covered a little bit of my next question, which is about what it was like working for President George W. Bush. You mentioned the incredibly complicated and terrible disaster of Hurricane Katrina with the SBA. But then, of course, you move in as a cabinet member and secretary for HUD. Now, I'm going to go ahead and explain. When people think about the great difficulties of that administration, you're thinking about three things. You're thinking about stock market collapse, Katrina. You're involved in both of those. Suppose only the Iraq War would be the one that you were not involved in, Afghanistan as well. But, I mean, working for HUD amid the stock market collapse triggered by foreclosures. You sat on the 5-person board for TARP, or the Troubled Asset Relief Program. How did you seek to continue to trust God for guidance during that time, support the president, carry out his priorities for the nations during some really, really difficult times in American history?
Yeah. So, that's all. So let me just say, sometimes it's easier to seek God hard when you're making a big decision than it is to seek him every day. Yeah. And certainly through that process and through other very challenging situations I've been in, I've learned that the real growth and the real blessing comes in living in God's strength every day when you're in those situations, and not in making sure you're holding fast to him in that pathway. With respect to President Bush, let me give you a few thoughts there. Despite what many people may believe, he is extremely smart. He is a very quick study on complex issues, and he has a remarkable ability to get his head around something complicated and see through solutions and pathways. He's also very committed to people who are suffering, and he also wants to get the job done right. I mean, he's a very results-oriented person. So in the Katrina situation, the job wasn't getting done. And I think it was very difficult for everybody in the administration. But obviously, I think he was the standard bearer there. So my marching orders were clear. Right. I'd like my job was to get in there and fix it. And fixing it had a lot of different pieces to it. Obviously, you know, but I guess when I came in, by the time I got in, it was 10 months after the storm, and there were 160,000 people in line to get a loan that hadn't arrived. SBA also had the lowest morale of any federal agency, based on the best places to work survey. There were, you know, the publicity was horrible. I had 20 congressional hearings in my first 15 months. So the drumbeat was pretty constant.
Wow.
And so I needed to lead in a way with a team, with a strong team that I did have, and I was very thankful for, to get funding into people's hands so they could rebuild their lives and their communities and move forward. And it was very difficult going down there and seeing the continuing situation. And we also needed to do it in a way that the people down there who were suffering felt like their government cared about them. And it was complicated because the way the support was set up, it was very impersonal. It was, you know, 800 numbers and, you know, PO boxes and stuff. And they very seldom had the ability to talk to a human being that cared about them. And we changed all of that when we changed the operational model. We needed to communicate publicly what we were doing, which was very important. And as a result, give people confidence in their government and reflect the progress that the administration was making, which was very important. And I believe that an important part of our job was to bring wholeness to the SBA organization, because what we had was a situation where a lot of people in the organization were there serving a mission. They were in the disaster recovery program, but effectively the operational machinery had almost collapsed, and they just couldn't move forward. And they wanted to serve, but they were losing. And losing meant that people were hurting. And being able to work with that team to put them in a different place was very important to me. And what I've learned, one of the things I've learned as a leader, is my happiest places are when my team is flourishing. Yeah. And when my team is able to do a great job. And I think that's one of the most important things I do. So that was what that job looked like. At HUD, the role was more multifaceted because of the complexity of the crisis, and it really covered a number of areas, like ensuring that, you know, capital was available for people buying homes because the market had closed up.
Right.
You know, people at risk of foreclosure could stay in their homes, implementing major housing legislation that had been passed, and then playing a supporting role in the TARP. I have to say, the TARP was really in the hands of Secretary Paulson and Bernanke, and a couple of us were in sort of supportive roles.
But you're still there when they learn that Citibank needs equity to survive, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that was actually right in the middle of my tenure. Yeah.
What is that like? I mean, what is that experience like?
Well, so, you know, I'd worked on Wall Street. I'd worked in financial services for 10 years. I'd been a CFO, so I had sort of lived in the financial world, right? And I knew very well that a lack of confidence in financial institutions can be lethal. And we had just seen Lehman fall apart and go under, and other institutions that were on the brink. And so when Citibank came forward, I mean, like the oxygen left the room. And I can still remember Secretary Paulson telling a few of this. So it was terrifying. And the intention of the TARP was not to put equity in banks. The intention of the TARP was to buy troubled assets from them, like mortgage securities and other things. And it's one of the reasons I was on the board, is because that was part of my domain. But it became clear that the issue was much deeper, and some of the largest banks in the world needed an equity infusion. And which was absolutely critical to bringing confidence back in those markets. But the reality was, on the heels, 2 months, I guess this was probably 2 months after Lehman Brothers, the reality was this could continue to go south very quickly, in a way that none of us really fully understood. And so the urgency was it was just more than code red, right? And so it was, I'm not sure how else to describe it, but it was, it was an incredible moment. And thankfully, you know, we had, you know, Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke, because they were an incredibly complimentary team, in really running into those places and making decisions.
Bring us up to date then with Goodwill, because it seems like what you do at Goodwill is such an excellent match for your everything from your family background to your sense of calling, to your work experience. And as you bring us up to date with Goodwill, though, you need to explain that I think a lot of us would hear your story, watch you talking about it, and think, what a good example of what we talk about all the time, integrating our faith in our work. But you don't like that phrase. So why don't you explain what you don't like about that phrase as you talk about how this sense of calling has really cohered in your leadership now at Goodwill.
So, yeah. So I think I was speaking on a faith and work panel when I said that. It wasn't the most popular thing to say. And by the way, Colin, I literally last night I opened up the annual report for the Gospel Coalition and I saw integration of faith and work sort of one of the tenets. So you're hitting me at just the right time.
I'm gonna go pull it up because I'm pretty sure Tim said that. So you'd have to.
Right in the ministry's mission. It's top of mind. So my issue is this. We can't view faith and work as separate domains that somehow need to get mushed together, right? There's one domain. And the one domain is faith. In every dimension, every inch of our lives, it need to be subsidiary to that or and be an outgrowth of that faith. They're all part of one domain. And I get why we say it. We say it because, you know, Christians, you know, often think of, okay, my faith is the good thing here and my work is kind of the hard thing that's not faith over here. Right. But we're falling desperately short of where God is taking us and using us if we think of that as a different thing. Our work needs to become our, you know, an outgrowth of our faith. Our worth is of God. He's created good things in advance for us to do, right? And that's why as we go into our work, we need to see all elements of it, serve all elements of it through our faith, whether it's how we lead, the messages we give, the decisions we make, and very importantly, the relationships we have and how we treat people in our work. So that's why I don't love the in Him we live and move and have our being, right? That's also when we go to work,
Which is where we spend most of our time.
Is where we spend most of our time and also where we can have our greatest impact for Him, right? And it's not in something over here. You know, if we're serving in a homeless shelter, and which obviously, given where I sit, is I believe is crucially important, but then go to work and say, okay, this is something else, we're really missing the point, right? And that's why I get concerned with that characterization.
Yeah. So how does this all cohere then at Goodwill? It just seems like such a good match for all these different things, as if it's what God had been preparing you to do.
Yeah. So Goodwill, you know, I had actually, 15 months or so before I got the call from a recruiter for the Goodwill job, I'd written, after a lot of prayer and reflection, a vision statement for myself, for my next job. And when I got the call for Goodwill, I realized that this was my vision statement. It filled it perfectly. And it was really about running an organization that provided opportunity for people in deep need to find a path forward for their benefit, their families, and for society. And then the other, it was the mission area is the mission area that God had put on my heart with just a great deal of intensity. But the other part of it is I love running businesses. I mean, that's kind of what I've done most of my life. I've been a CFO, and I've been the CEO of two companies. I love the stuff of business. It makes sense to me. And so at Goodwill, it's really the combination of the two. And our model is the combination of the two, right? We have this, you know, massive network of stores and other things, other business activities, which then provide job opportunities within the stores and provide funding to run job centers and all sorts of other relief. Now, I don't run the stores. I run an organization that that services that vast network with all kinds of supports to help them do their work more effectively. So it really comes together for me in a powerful way. And it also gives me a platform to talk about things I care deeply about that I don't feel our society understands well enough to really begin having the kind of impact we need. So it covers a lot of bases for me.
What do you mean? Elaborate on that last point.
Well, just the conversation we've been having, let me just give you an example. I was working on a joint op-ed with another very well-known company, a private sector company. And I talked about, you know, how we need to help people. And it was kind of a simple thing, but I basically said, we have to make sure that people have skills for the future, right? For the jobs that are being created. We need to make sure that we serve their human needs along the way so they can get through that job preparation process. And thirdly, companies have to recognize people for their skills and not just hire them for degrees, but really hire people with the talent and the skills they need rather than degrees that don't matter. And they continually ask me to take out that middle part, which is, if I'm housing insecure, I need to have a place to live. If I can't pay my water bills, I need support along the way. If I don't have transportation. And what they were basically saying is, well, forget about the human need piece, but we're pretty cool with saying, like, give them digital skills and work with companies to give them the job. And we were gutting the whole middle of the human and what it would take for that human who'd never seen this kind of a path forward, didn't know that if they took this kind of a class, it could get them a job, didn't have the ability to get through the process because their lives weren't stable enough. They completely missed the person. And if we're going to dignify the person, and if we're truly going to help them move forward in their lives, we need to look at the whole person. And I think in many ways, it's a reflection of how God works within our lives, right? If anyone is a new creation, in Christ, he's a new creation. The old is gone, the new has come. But, you know, along that, but there's also sort of this concept of working out our salvation, right? And there are all the things that we deal with and the way God deals with in our own lives to bring him closer to him. There's a similar reflection here where people need to deal with all of these things in their lives, be able to move forward. And if we don't get that, we miss this huge opportunity to take people from deep need, help people get from deep need to great opportunity. And that's kind of that middle piece that I'm talking about.
Last thing that I can, I mean, there's so many encouraging things, so many things I've learned from you in the last year, so many things I learned from you just preparing for this interview. And you're often speaking to rooms of business, nonprofit leaders, given your history, given your current role. Think of a place like the Gospel Coalition National Conference or the Gospel Coalition Council Meeting or the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics, our fellows. If I put you in a room of those church leaders, what would you want them to know about your work and your broader perspective?
What I would want them to know is a lot of people like me and a lot of people in their congregations need to be equipped. And they need to be equipped to be confident and purposeful as people of faith serving in all the domains where we serve, whether we're teachers or doctors or office workers or organizational leaders or parents. And we need to be equipped, especially because our world has changed so much. And I'm not talking about technology or those things. I'm talking about the fundamental assumptions that people in society have on really fundamental issues. And I'm sure you've seen surveys that look at, you know, where sort of the, you know, 20 to 30 year olds think relative to 50 to 60 year olds. I don't know if there's ever been a time in my understanding where the basic views of younger people and older people are so far apart. And especially as people who are in leadership or our parents or are serving young people, knowing how to enter those places where we're speaking to people in ways that they can, in ways that meet them where they are, it's so critical. And so my recommendation was would be to know the world that all of us that are not in vocational ministry are operating, and think about how to equip us in those places, so that they truly are all outgrowths of our faith, and we can do it with confidence.
That's good. In fact, I was talking with one of our friends, Catherine Alsdorf, recently about this in relation to the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics, about how we can grow in that area more. And it was definitely a big part of Tim's vision for the gospel and culture. And it's what brought me to you. And it's why you've been such a tremendous encouragement and help in the last year. I do have one last question, which is a question I've often asked. So we're not going to let you off the hook with books on this podcast. So, Steve, what's the last great book you've read?
Yeah, so I recently read and then reread a novella. You'll be familiar with it because I remember your interview of Morty Shapiro and Gary Saul Mortensen. It's a Tolstoy novella called The Death of Ivan Illich.
Oh.
And I got to tell you, Colin, there was never a point in reading this book where I just didn't feel it. And you start this book in the end of the story, which is his people finding about his death and his funeral. And it's people that are fond of him, people that have worked with him, but every aspect of their conversation was transactional, right? Who would get a promotion because of his position? Who would get a raise? What's the right thing to do at the funeral to look right? And then you go to the beginning of his life and you see the trajectory of his life and what he lives for, educational and professional and social success, and how he kind of lives into that. And then as his life falters and ultimately he faces his death, he becomes very bitter and angry. But it was really at the very end when he realizes that what he lived for was thin. It was that there just really wasn't any substance to it. He actually finds peace because he realizes at the end of his life, kind of the truth. And it comes sort of after a priest comes in and gives him a blessing. And you see this sort of sense of repentance almost and a sense of redemption at the end. And it wasn't long after reading that a friend of mine who's a very successful person, private equity, had seen somebody else in the same profession, didn't know him well. And the guy came up to him and said, hey, I hear you're kind of a religious guy. And I actually just lost my job. And this person began weeping. He told me this story. And I said, you got to give him this book. You got to give him this book because there's hope, but you have to look where that hope is. It was a powerful book.
I like that. I like that. Any Russian literature suggestions on gospel balance are welcome.
I might be sweet. Hopefully you didn't find my summary objectionable.
No, you snuck in. I appreciate it, Steve. My guest this week on Gospel Balance, Steve Preston, President and CEO of Goodwill Industries International. Steve, thanks for your teaching here. Thank you for your example. Thank you for your encouragement. You're a real blessing. Thanks, Steve.
Oh, thank you so much, Colin. It's really been a joy.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Gospel Bound. For more interviews and to sign up for my newsletter, head over to tgc.org/gospelbound. Rate and review Gospel Bound on your favorite podcast platform so others can join the conversation. Until next time, remember, when we're bound to the gospel, we abound in hope.